So do you want to just start out by giving me your name, your house, and maybe what categories you identify with?
My name is Sebastian Escada. I'm an icon, Sebastian the Icon from the House of Escada. I walk fashion categories, including best dress, foot and eyewear, labels, anything that has to do with fashion and ballroom. I've been in ballroom for 25 years. I've just been inducted into the Hall of Fame this past weekend, and I first started walking balls in 1995.
Okay, so before we get to your first ball, give me a little bit of background. Where were you born? When were you born? What was your city like growing up?
I was born in Winnsboro, South Carolina. I'm the only child. I went to school at a high school called Fairfield Central High. There in high school, I was a drum major. So I think being a drum major and being in JROTC, it gave me an opportunity to learn how to deal with people as far as directing them in different ways as far as band. I played the saxophone back at home. I was from a small town where it was probably maybe 2,000 people. I was close to Columbia, South Carolina, and I was there until I reached age 20.
And then at age 20, what?
Age 20, I moved and I was going to college, and I left there and went to college to UNC in Charlotte, North Carolina, is where I went to school.
Okay. And what year was that?
This was 1993.
Okay, so that was 2 years before?
This is like 2 or 3 years before I went to ballroom because my whole thing was once I got into college, that was the first time that I actually was away from home and I saw that life was bigger than what I thought it was. And I was out, you know, having fun with different people, and I went to Atlanta. And when I went to Atlanta, that's where I saw the lifestyle as far as people having, you know, more things to do. And I decided to switch and go to school in Atlanta.
And what do you mean when you say the lifestyle?
During that time, we had Freaknik, and I've never experienced going to Freaknik before. And then we had
What is that?
Freaknik was it was a time where all the colleges would come and they would celebrate a time of the year where everybody would come from all the black AUC colleges and have parties all over the city. And they did it in Atlanta back then, back in 93, 94, 95. So I took my first trip down there and saw how it was a big time where people were together and just having fun. And I had relatives that lived there, cousins that went to school at Morehouse. So I was on their campus, and my whole thing was now I really want to be in Atlanta.
And so when was it that you came out?
When I came out for the lifestyle?
Yeah, I guess as gay or however you
Oh,
identify.
I came out around maybe 89 or 90. I came out right before and right during the time of high school, but a lot of people didn't know that. So once I left home, I think I really decided to say, okay, now I'm free. I can tell people, I can do more things. You know, what I really want to do, I was home with my parents. I couldn't do everything I wanted to do. So I took that time, and that's what I did.
Tell me a little bit about your parents, and your relationship with them, I guess, growing up.
My mother, she worked two jobs. My father, he was a deputy warden for a prison system in South Carolina, Columbia. He did that for 35 years. My father was never really at home. I was with my mother all the time, and I was the only child. So most of the time during the day, during the night, I was always with my mother. So that was the person who I was with all the time until my mother died in 2000, in 1994. And at that time, growing up, me and my father didn't really have a relationship. So when my mother passed, you know, I wasn't left alone, but I was able to live without my mom because I left at a time where I was in school and I was already separated from her and I was coming back to visit her. So not having a father like figure there all the time, maybe it did make me into a a person more where I'm able now to deal with certain situations because he wasn't there. But it wasn't a bad thing that he wasn't there because I did understand that he was working and he was taking care of other things for us.
And so your mom died in 94, and then you got involved in ballroom in 95?
I got involved in ballroom. It actually happened in 94. I got involved in ballroom. At the time when I was in Atlanta, I actually met a group of friends that were going to Morehouse, and at the time our house was called the House of Evangelista. So I don't know if you ever heard of Pause, when they have on the show, they mentioned the House of Evangelista. Okay, that was the house, and that was the name of my house back then. And we were all just friends, and we were all going out just to have fun at clubs.
That was your ballroom house?
Yeah, it was called the House of Evangelista at first.
Okay.
When we decided to take our house on a platform of mainstream ballroom, we decided to change the name to the House of Escada.
And back up just a little bit, how did you even hear about ballroom in the first place?
I actually was dating someone in ballroom, and they took me to a ball, and I thought it was a fashion show, and they actually participated in the ball. They was like, I want you to come with me to this fashion show, and I was like, where is it? It was like, it's in New York City. I was like, what time does it start? They was like, well, it started a little later on. Will you please come? So I went there like a normal time for a fashion show. At that fashion show, I met Jack Mizrahi at the door, and during this time, Jack just saw me. He was like, oh, my God, you're so cute. What are you doing here? I said, I'm looking for this person. I'm going to leave that person nameless. I'm looking for this person. And what time does the fashion show start? He said, well, it starts late. Just stand back here with me. And that's where I met Jack. And on that very night, while waiting with Jack, I saw different people coming in. It was like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was still trying to figure out, like, where are all these people going? Some were dressed crazy. At the time, I didn't know anything about ballroom. So I just saw people coming in, Jack collecting money. Then the FBI came in. And during this time when the FBI came in, I was standing there. And they were asking questions about Doreen Corey. And Doreen Corey, you know, had died. And they had found her ex-boyfriend's body in her chest. So they were trying to find information on what happened. And this is how, like, I came to the ballroom with the Doreen Corey situation. So I was like, oh, my God.
Okay. It couldn't have been higher drama.
Right. It was drama before I even entered into the ball. So that night I saw my friend walk out for his category, which was face. And I just saw.
Wait, before you go on. Can you, if somebody is listening to this, they don't know who Jack Mizrahi is, can you explain who he is now?
Jack Mizrahi will be an icon for the commentation in ballroom. He has been around for years. As many years as I have been in ballroom, he and a few others, which are not here anymore, like Eric Bazaar, would commentate these events as masters of ceremony. They will be the people that will let you know what category is next, what is it calling for. To me, they would be the true historians because they have the stories of all the things that has happened at balls. They know who walked in one of those categories. When it comes down to being deemed or calling people a legend or icon, they can actually identify with what that person has done in ballroom because they were actually there to see it that night. Those are really like the true historians that can actually give you what you actually need from, you know, understanding what happened in those times.
And do they, as historians, are there times when they tell that history? Like, how does that happen?
It may be a time in the ballroom where there may be a category, and Jack may remember it was a category 10 years ago. He's like, bring it like Octavia St. Laurent on the same night when she brought it in a gown. You know, they'll just use different things to make you feel that same energy that happened back then. They'll just have a time where they just talk about it.
And
in ballroom.
When you say that, do you mean that that's written into the categories? Or that
no, just vocally. He may have the microphone, and he'd say, I remember this night. It was a night like this where Octavia, she came from the ceiling. Let's try to make it a night like that. Or he'll just start talking about different events that happen at balls while he's on the microphone. So it all depends on the feeling of the commentator and what all they know and what all they remember. Or somebody may have a production that, you know, kind of remind you of a production that happened 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody may pay homage to another person that have died or left the scene with the same identical recreation of that for a category. So it's many ways to still keep history going on and on in ballroom.
And it's not just telling the history, it's asking people to, like, embody it.
Embody the history, invoke the person. You know, it all depends on whatever the category is calling for.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Okay, that's amazing. So I need to interview more commentators then, right?
Yeah.
If they're the historians.
Yes, yes. Okay. Commentators are historians.
Okay. So back to this first ball you went to, What were you feeling? What was your response when you met Jack and he was like, oh, you're really cute, and then the FBI came in and you saw all these people?
It was just so much going on. So at that very moment, I couldn't really process everything. I think I had to wait till I get back home because at that time, I wasn't in ballroom yet. So I went back home and I processed everything, and I was like, wow, this is a lot. I don't think I could do it. That's what's my first initial thing was, I don't think I could do it.
Why?
I wasn't ready yet for ballroom. I had just really came out. So I was saying to myself, I think if I was to do ballroom, I know I'm living my lifestyle as being gay. This would put me on another platform of being even more gay. And a lot of people at that time didn't understand what ballroom was. They would just think that I was way out there, like just way out there. And I was trying to debate, should I or should I not? But once I got back home and I had a conversation with some of my friends that were thinking about taking ballroom mainstream, I decided to go ahead and go with it. And my house was the first house in Atlanta because ballroom started up north. So there was no house in the south. So my house was the first house in the south to start ballroom and have the very first ball. And that's what made the House with Scott and made me the brand I am today, because I'm the first person to actually judge balls up north and made a whole system down south where people now have ballroom down south. So whenever there are wars or whenever they're doing anything, they're always paying homage back to me, my house, and everything that we embodied back then to create space for them now.
And so if it didn't exist there, how did you know how to create it?
There were a few people that attended Morehouse. They were in houses in New York that were not a part of the South House. They came down with their members to have a conversation with us and actually told us, this is what is needed for you guys to really take it mainstream. You have what it takes, but you to make it a real brand, you need to compete up north, you know. Starting down south is fine, but you have to bring it up north to let everybody know that you're here. And we did that for years and years and years until finally, you know, we basically pushed through and persevered. Where when we first started, by us being from the south, we were like, who are these little boys? What do they think they're doing? This is New York. Where are you coming from? Atlanta? You're not going to win anything from Atlanta. So we had to really concentrate and do things out the box to stand out among all the people and all the houses.
And when you say bring it mainstream, what does that mean?
Some of the categories would call for you to have a production. And we had never really done anything mainstream before. And our first time coming up there, our house was a face house. And a face house meaning some houses are defined for different categories. You may be in a fashion house. You may be in a runway house. You may be in a face house. You may be in a face and runway house. You may be in a performance house. Your house is known for one or two or maybe even three things. Our house was known for face and fashion. So we brought face, whatever category was in New York, we would try to do that category and spend as much money and time to make sure it was executed correctly. And majority of the times when we did it, we stood out because we were the underdogs, and the underdogs were bringing it like the super dogs. Mm-hmm. So that's what helped us.
And how do you know that you're actually a house? Because I was talking with somebody at the university yesterday, and they were like, oh, well, could students at the university become a house? And I was like, I don't think so. But, like, who decides if you're a house or not?
Well, you and your group decides together if you really want to commit to being a house. And if you want your house to be a part of ballroom, there are other houses that are not a part of ballroom. You have other houses that are a part of the pageant system. Mm-hmm. You know, they support their pageant members, and you know, they may call themselves the Dupree's. They may call themselves different names. But when you come in ballroom, you already under the umbrella of the things that go along in ballroom. So you're now saying you're ready to compete, to show your talent on the floor. And I consider your talent on the floor is like we all have different hobbies that we enjoy. So you can find one of those hobbies that you enjoy in ballroom. If you fit into one of those categories, that's the one that you will most predominantly walk, if you feel like that's a part of you. With me, it's definitely fashion. And I've been judging balls now for 24 years, because coming from the South and going North, I've judged balls in Baltimore. I've judged balls in Philadelphia. I've judged balls in Virginia, all over. So, yeah.
And can you be a ballroom house if you don't compete in balls? Or is that a requirement?
It's a requirement that you compete in balls, but not all houses compete all the time in balls. Like, you may have your season where you want your house to compete. You may be on blackout for right now. So there's no true criteria as far as being a ballroom house besides just actually walking balls. That's it.
And so most people I've talked with came into ballroom into a house that already existed, and they had mothers and fathers. It sounds like your story is different.
Right. We didn't have a mother and father. I was actually the mother of the house, and we had a mother before me. He was in school as well. He attended – everybody that was in the House of Escada, they actually attended Morehouse. I was the only one that didn't. I was from a whole other school, so – when we all came together, we promoted, when we changed our names, and I was promoted to the new mother of the house. And we had the father, who is the founding father, Tony Escada. So if you look at Tony Escada, you look at me, Tony Escada would be considered Thomas Edison, the creator of the light. I would be GE. I just made the light brighter. So that's the way we always look at it as far as our house.
And you were both in Atlanta, and you both founded the house in Atlanta.
Him and his peers on the campus founded the House of Evangelista, which became an evangelista. But then when we changed our name to Escada, because we felt like we were more familiar with Linda Evangelista. We all loved Linda Evangelista, the supermodel. So that's why our house was named Evangelista. And then we was trying to find out what house could we name it, because most houses resembles fashion labels of houses. And I think during that year, Linda Evangelista, in 1996 or 1995, she was on a campaign for the house, for Escada. She did a campaign. So when she did the campaign, and we just like, Linda Escada. So we went with that. Yeah.
And how old were you when you became mother of the house?
I was 24.
Okay.
I was 24 years old.
So you can be young and still be a mother.
You can be young and be a mother. I think by me, before ballroom, I always had friends and other friends that were younger than me that always came to my house, and we would eat. I would make sure they was okay. I would even take a few to school. You know, I was always doing those things. And I think maybe I was doing those things because as a child, I saw how hard my mother was doing things and my father wasn't there. So they would all come to me, have conversations with me. And, you know, some of them felt like I was just as young as they were. So we would talk about some of the most things that they wouldn't even talk to other people about. So I was more like a mother-father to them. So they would call me mom. Some would call me dad. And it just happened, you know, organically like that. Even the ones in college, they would come over, we would have conversations, and they just felt like I was just a person they could talk to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's another question, is what's the difference between a mother and a father in ballroom?
Really, nowadays, there isn't one, but back then, the father was head of the household, and the mother actually ran the house. But nowadays...
What do you mean by ran the house?
Like the kids, you know, when the kids are not doing what they're supposed to do correctly, the mother makes sure when it's time for balls or in their real life, what are you doing? You need to be in school. I'm going over here. I'm going to talk to your principal, you know. And most of the kids in ballroom back then, they were kids who had left home or the parents no longer wanted them to be a part of their family. So they looked up to the person who they considered their mom or their father to actually guide them the correct way. So a lot of these mothers of houses stepped in as the role model, as a real mom to them. And the fathers, you know, whenever they needed anything or whatever they could provide for them, they were there. Or if anything happened outside of the house, the kids were like, that's my mom, that's my dad. You're not going to – it's just – it was basically you was creating a family nucleus with all these kids and different members of your family.
Mm-hmm. What? How did that feel to you?
To me, I don't know. I mean, I just felt like everybody just felt that I was just a great person to talk to. I had stories for a lot of people and things that happened to me, and I think we could relate to one another because I never judged anybody when I listened to their stories. I just try to find out what would help them to see a better day or whatever. And I didn't have any, like, really bad days as far as me coming out or doing what I want to do because in school I did what I was supposed to do. I left home. I decided to live my lifestyle away from home. But a lot of people choose to do it younger, and sometimes it affects the family. And I'd never had to experience that part. And once I left home, I actually had, you know, two jobs, working at McDonald's, you know, working at a gas station, going to school, you know, things like that nature. So by the time I reached Atlanta, I was stable enough to actually have conversations with different people and living my own life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that part of you liked being in the position of mother and, like, being able to tend to the children and everything.
Yeah, because you find out a lot of kids have a lot of things that they're dealing with, not just conversations. Sometimes, you know, they may call you and say, oh, my God, I missed the car payment, you know. And you're a parent, and if you able to help and assist, okay, you know, you're in school, you're doing what you're supposed to do, if it's possible, you know. We could see, can we do that? That's some of the things that I was doing. I was actually helping the ones that were in school that couldn't afford to go to some of these balls. You know, I would rent cars. I would rent a van. We would all get in a van, and we would go up north. I would find out what everybody's schedule was, what day they had to be back to school for classes. If we left Friday after class, we were definitely back by Sunday night for class Monday morning. Now, that part I would not, you know, make them lose out on. I just felt like anybody was in school that was more important than going to a ball.
In school, you mean college?
College, yeah. They were in college. Many of them was in college, but they didn't have the income to do things. And during 95, you know, if I look back on some of the things I did when my mother died, you know, I had money put to the side. So I was definitely using some of those things to do some of the things that I couldn't physically do if I had to do it, I couldn't probably do it. But I did use some, you know, things like that to help out.
And what was your role as mother in terms of the balls?
I was there to be the head figure of the house. Whenever it was time for us to go different places, I was there to actually be there as the person that made sure that they were walking their categories. If I was judging that night, all the kids were there, they were being accompanied by me. So by nobody really knowing who my kids were, and the people in the ballroom knew me, and all they had to do was say they were in the house of Scotta, and if anything happened at night, they knew those kids came with Sebastian. So they were already told, if anything happens at an event, you know, come to me, find someone that you see me talking to, you know, get to me as quick as possible because you never know what may happen. They were a long way from home, so I just made sure that they were all safe wherever we went. 99% of the time we went out of town, we stayed at the Marriott on the Financial Center, World Trade Center. That's where we stayed every time we came to New York. We stayed there, so they always knew how to get back to the hotel if they did go out with somebody else when we were leaving. I think I organized pretty well with them.
And New York, was that considered like the center of the ballroom world?
Yeah, okay. New York was the center. New York is the center of ballroom. It's the ballroom mecca. So in order for you to be a real house, you have to go through New York. There's no way you cannot go through New York. You have to go to New York, and you have to definitely travel to Atlanta. You definitely have to, you know, be out there. Now, back then, it wasn't all these other states. It was just New York, and it was Jersey, and, you know, we didn't have a West Coast. We didn't have Florida. We didn't have Texas like we have now. And we didn't have Atlanta, and Atlanta was being built. But people started coming to Atlanta once we had our first ball.
Okay. When was that?
1996. We had our first Winter Celtics ball in Atlanta. I think that night we drew in about 1,200 people.
And from
where? From all over, because it was the first ball in Atlanta, and it was at Trax. And everybody just heard about it. I remember passing out flyers months and months, you know, giving people our flyers here and there and everything. And when that ball, you know, we had the ball, it was like, wow. It was people from all over, from New York. It was icons. At the time, I wasn't an icon. I wasn't a legend. I wasn't a statement. I was just new to ballroom. I was a star. You know, and it just let me know that there were things that we were doing correctly that I wanted to see, you know, later in life, how would it go for us. And I wanted to, every year I would say I wanted to go another year, because a lot of people who graduated from Morehouse, they decided to step away from the ballroom scene that was with me in the beginning. So I'm the last one of the oldest one of the members in the house that's still there helping the house.
Mm-hmm. So you said when you went to college, it felt like a whole new world kind of opened up for you.
Yeah.
Did it feel the same when you started getting involved in ballroom? Because ballroom is like its own world as well.
It was different. In college, they gave me the space where I could be free. But once I got into ballroom, it was I don't know what we're saying, heaven. It was an open world where people had the opportunity to do everything they wanted to do. You didn't have to worry about what people thought about you when you was doing those things. You didn't really care. You just wanted to express yourself. So, you know, when you start walking balls can be very addictive, and it'll give you that adrenaline rush that you always wanted, that you never felt. And sometimes it definitely makes you feel better, you know, if it's coming from a real good place. I liked it a lot.
And what, I don't know, I mean, like, tell me more about what was available to you outside of ballroom, like in terms of gay spaces or black spaces. What was unique about ballroom? Like, what need did that fill for you?
Ballroom, what was different from any other space, it gave you an opportunity to be yourself. And I just feel like there's more inside of every person, and ballroom just allowed you to do those things that you couldn't do on the streets. You couldn't do certain things that you wanted to do in public all the time because you had other people watching you. People didn't understand that ballroom was actually a space where you showed your talent or your creative side. And, you know, you never want to be ridiculed by some things that you do totally different from other people. So ballroom provided a space for different demographics to come in and have a meeting place of competition. So my thing was, you know, I've always saw people who dance totally different from other people. By me being a drum major, I see all different types of dance. But once I got in ballroom and saw Vogue, and once I saw people doing all these different things that I've never seen before, it just made me realize that the world is not as small as I thought it was. It's actually big. So I just felt like me being there and me trying to understand what was actually going on, if I had to go back and have a conversation with someone who didn't really grasp what the whole true idea of ballroom was, I could easily tell them exactly what it is.
And I'm going to push you a little bit. Tell me specifically what you can do in ballroom that you couldn't do, like, on the sidewalk. Give me some examples.
Runway. like we see all these different models walk the Victoria's Secret runway and how they are the women going up and down the street, going up and down the runway, showing you the things they have on. You couldn't, if you saw a normal person walking down the street doing the same thing that a person would be doing in a Victoria's Secret runway, you would think they were like crazy. If you're not standing in a circle and you saw someone dancing and people not standing around giving them money or throwing it there and they just break out dancing, totally something you never seen before, you would thought they was on drugs. So it's definitely a place and a time for everything. But sometimes people want to live their life free. And when you see those things, you don't know where they're coming from. You don't know why it's happening, but it's happening because the underground aspect of ballroom is trying to come through. It's like trying to cage a lion up inside of a cage, and it's been caged for so long, and now it's trying to fight its way out. So a lot of times you'll see these outbursts of people saying things or doing different things that you never heard, chants. People probably hear people chanting all day and don't know what they're saying, but it's just ballroom trying to release itself, trying to be a part of the world.
So there are like frustrations that people have to release.
Right.
In ballroom.
You have to release,
So it's like an escape valve.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yes.
Okay. Let me see. Okay. You talked about when you started ballroom, talked about what attracted you to the ballroom, blah, 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 blah. You talked about the history of your house, which was not long when you founded it.
Right. So it's only been 25 years.
Let's see. And then, I'm curious, because now you're in the house since the beginning.
Mm.
How do you tell that history of the house? Like, in what circumstances would you talk to somebody in ballroom about the history of your house?
Many people in ballroom that are fathers that were there when I was there, they already know. But as far as now, because social media is so widely being used and utilized, we actually have inside of our page where we have our bylaws and our history, and it's been in there for years. So if you join my house and you go onto that page, you will see how it started, how the people from Morehouse, me, how our house almost split, our house colors, what they represent. You know, like our colors for our house is red. Red give us fire. Black is for the boldness. We have gold and silver, which is a part of our creative side. So if that night, if we ever use those colors at a ball, you will see where the House of Scotta is getting its power from, those colors. And we just do that for any people that's coming in now that's new or old or just don't know the history. And we have that page set up for them. A lot of people didn't know that me, myself, and Tony Scotta was the first person who made the category Realness with a Twist. See, we made that at a Scotta ball in Atlanta, 1997, and we had that category first. And when Jack saw the category, Jack was like, oh, my God, this is so nice. I have to do it up north. So Jack took that category that we made, and he put it up north, and they decided to have it at every ball. And people are now legends in that category, and that category was started by me and Tony Escada.
Okay, tell me more about this, because I would say that Realness with a Twist is my favorite category.
Oh, okay. Well,
and I insisted that we have it.
When you said that, I was gonna say something to you about it, but I was like, you know, I was like, oh my God, you love it. Back then, when we made that category, we wanted that category to be for a person who really didn't walk performance. It will be for a person who walked thug, and we want the thug person to emulate another person in ballroom who walk performance, which is a femme queen. So the whole objective was to see a thug come out and everybody be like, you about to walk? And then he started performing as a femme queen, like as one of the girls in our ballroom scenes that's really big is Sanaya Ebony. To see a thug performing like Sanaya Ebony, selling sex, but Vogue and femme, it was really funny. it was like unbelievable, but those were the people who would actually get 10s versus the one who today who really knows how to vogue. It's supposed to be very much as if a kiki makes you laugh and say, I can't believe he just did that. That's how it was at first, but over the years it turned into the person knows how to vogue and look like a thug, but that's not the true way it was from the beginning.
So originally it was kind of a joke.
It was a joke.
And it was something to make you
make you laugh and make you awe. Like you'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe he just vogued. He was acting like Sanaya. And then you go home on the phone and you say, did you see so and so last night who walked up? And he really don't vogue. He's not supposed to really know how to vogue. He's just doing it out of fun for that night.
And so when he did vogue in that category, would he do it correctly?
It didn't matter. It didn't matter if he did it correctly or not. It was the point of we could see him voguing like a film queen, and we would like, this is crazy. And he would get 10s, and we would pick the one who actually did it that we enjoyed the most. They didn't have to do it correctly, that we thought like was the biggest wow factor of the night. So that's how we would pick that category.
And when you say the biggest wow factor, like the funniest?
Or he tried to do it. We knew where he was going with it when he tried to do it. Did you see him pull his shirt up over his, you know, tied up in a knot, you know, and he's really a thug. Like, it was all out of fun. But when Jack saw it, he took it up north, and they actually turned into a category, and well, they turned into a national category. And it just went from there.
And now it's more kind of like you're supposed to be able to do thug absolutely correctly and
perform
yes. absolutely correctly.
Yes. So that right there will, if we look at ballroom 25 years ago where it first started from that category, 25 years later it has evolved. So that's how ballroom moves on a real scale.
And that's how any art form,
right,
you know, moves. Like, it's constantly changing, because mm-hmm. if it doesn't, then it's dead.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. I like that story. I don't know. I mean, like, I guess when I read about it, like, you know, there are academic books about ballroom, and they talk about realness with a twist. Like, Marlon Bailey has a book, Butch Queen Up in Drags, which is about ballroom in Detroit.
Okay.
He has this whole section where he talks about realness with a twist. And I think for him, it's like, okay, realness with a twist is about demonstrating how gender is socially constructed. Like, gender's not a real thing. It's just how you kind of perform it.
Yeah. But, you know, he is basing it off of what he's probably seen and from when you put a spin on the category and you change it. So he's basing off of what he's seen, but the true nature of the category wasn't designed like that. But in actuality, it has became its own category. Now, it's like when you have a ball, when we did it, we were just throwing it in. But now at a ball, you have to have that category in your ball. So that is great in itself. And now they also have another one called Realness with a Twist, where someone else redone it, where you can walk realness, but on this part of the twist, you walk American Runway.
Okay.
So they have, that's another part. It's called Thug Realness with a Twist. They call it Thug Realness with a Twist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Too complicated for me. Okay. Let's see. What brought you in? Blah, blah, blah. History of your house. Mothers and fathers. Tell me just a little bit more about the categories you walk and why they appeal to you.
The fashion categories. The fashion categories appeal to me. Best dressed spectator. Back then it was called head to toe overness, or it was labels. As a child, my mother used to make clothes. She used to sew for a living. That was one of her other jobs. I used to be with her all the time when she would go to the fabric stores, pick out fabrics, ask me, how does this feel? I like this. You know, my favorite thing is tweed. I like to dress in the wintertime. I love when my mother made and created things in the wintertime. She used to get a pattern from Butterwick, Vogue, all these different name brands, and she would make her own outfits for Sundays when she go to church. So I was always around fashion, per se, with my mom, and she would wear things, and people would be like, oh, my God, where did you get that from? And she was like, I made it. And people were like, you made that? Yeah. So I'm like, oh, my God, okay, could you think you could do some wedding dresses, or you could do some bridesmaids dresses? So I'd be right there with her watching her cut it out. I never got an opportunity to get on the sewing machine. I wish I had. But I would pick out buttons for her. Then my mom was an interior decorator. So I think just being an interior decorator, learning where to put things as far as in your house, dealing with lines, and with her being able to tailor her own clothes, it gave me a part of me. So when I decided to figure out what I wanted to do in ballroom, I was like, fashion, let me try that out. And then I saw by watching different people walk that category before I did, and I was saying to myself, I could do that. You know, I can pick out my own stuff. I can do that. Okay. That looks easy.
And if somebody's listening to this, they don't know what the fashion category is. Can you break it down?
The fashion category would be if best dress is wearing clothes, going to an event. Normally the categories will say to you, I want to see the person come in tonight looking as if they were about to receive an award. How would you look if you were going to receive a award is what the category is saying to you. It's saying to me, how do I want to look? I may not look the best to everybody, but to me, I may look the best. And when I hit the runway, I want to receive my 10s. Once you receive your 10s in ballroom, you go into a battle zone. So, you know, there's two parts of ballroom. There's a battle zone. And most of the time, the people that win those categories are the ones that have the most confidence. And I think I'm very confident because I love fashion. I know what my mother used to do. So that is, I'm getting confidence from my mother when I hit the floor. I think about my mom. So it's coming from a good place with me. So I'm thinking about things that she would have done if she was wearing what I was wearing, how she would be acting. So it kind of like go hand in hand for me.
I guess that's another way that history comes into the ball. It's like your own personal history too.
Yeah. Yeah. I draw energy from anything that I feel like is going to help me on the floor whenever I have to be in the battle zone. But outside of ballroom, I was just a regular, normal, everyday person. But there are people who work in fashion, and they live fashion 24/7 in their life, and they're walking balls too. But that does not mean these people are going to be a person like me when it comes to ballroom. It all depends on what are you doing that night, your attitude, your fit, your everything. It's just the whole total package. So you never should underestimate your opponent based off of what you do in real life, because there are some people in ballroom who are executives in real life, and then they also bring that executiveness to the floor, and sometimes it doesn't translate for the next person they're walking against who is not even executive. He may wash dishes for a living, you know, but that person that night did that extra mile because he knew he had to actually battle you for that category. So, you know, some nights some people feel like they should win. A lot of people may feel like they should win when I walk, but I feel like on the floor, I do what I'm supposed to do. I know what to do against my opponent.
Okay, well, tell me about like a typical ball. If you're preparing for the fashion category, tell me about a little bit like about the months that are leading up to that night, and then how you approach that night and how you approach the actual category.
If there was a ball that I wanted to walk, or there were balls which most of the time they have these categories, I'll read the category and see, do I feel like that's a category for me? That's the first thing. If I feel like it is one for me, maybe 5 to 6 months before that ball, I'll start looking around for different things. I'll think about what time of season that is. Because if I see the flyer in the summertime and the ball is in the wintertime, I don't want to wear summertime outfit in the wintertime on the floor. Some people don't think like that. They might just be like, let me just get this out. So I like to be in season when I walk. So if I walk that ball, I'm going to do that. And I want to be in season. And after that, I began a process where I tried to find those things that I want to wear. And, you know, after I find my actual suit or whatever I'm planning on wearing, because I feel like in ballroom I'm a gender bender. I feel like I can mix and I can mix women clothing and men clothing together, and you don't know if it's men or women clothing. All you know is a style. I'm more of a style person, so I don't feel like a woman's top and a man's top should define me on the floor. I feel like style, because every night or every ball, you don't want to see the same look that you saw a night before. You don't want to, that's just too narrow. So I like to bend fashion. Not all the time it's successful, but I like to bend it where your mind just takes you to another place where you just feel like, oh my God, what is that? Well, I never saw that before. I like to do things like that.
And specifically, like, bending the rules of gender or just
bending anything? The rules of fashion, as far as I might have on a feminine top, but I might have on a man pair of pants, and I might have on a woman's hat. You don't know. I may bend it. I may change something of it. I might take something off and add something to it. But everybody don't think like that. Some people feel like, you know, I have to be in all men's clothing. Well, why did you beat me? Because you're not in all men's clothing. This is a fashion category. If you are a fashion person, you should be able to wear anything. Nothing. You should be able to take that rug off the floor and turn it into a gown if you had to. I don't know. But you should not let anything stop you in fashion, because nowadays people are wearing all different types of things from different countries. You don't know if it's man, woman, or whatever. All you just know is it's wearable, and if you got to turn it over and use the opposite side of it, then do it. That's how I feel.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me, the night of, when you're in the ball, you're waiting to hear the category being called, like, what are you thinking? How are you preparing?
Well, I didn't prepare like 3 days prior to that, but at the ball, I'm definitely not in my outfit yet. I'm actually sitting there in maybe jeans and t-shirt. And maybe when I find out where the category is, I'm getting myself prepared. It's more of a mental thing for me. At that point, I feel like I've done everything I possibly could for my house. So now all I need to do is do my own thing spiritually and mentally, where I'm getting my mind and my body connected to my category. And I would rather for my house to be more waiting for me to come out or assisting me. And that's just me. I don't like a lot of people around me during that time, because I don't walk that much now. One time I used to walk all the time, but I may have been in ballroom so long, I may walk now once every 3 years. So, and majority of the time when I do walk, once every 3 years I win. So, so I try not to be on the floor that much. And I like being a mentor now. I like to help other people in different houses, you know, try to give them the trick or the trade for the category, let them know that just because people are wearing Gucci and Balenciaga now, you don't have to be one of those persons. You can be a person who you found a brand new label and you want to display that on the floor, and you just choose the right outfit and you say that's what you have on with a bunch of confidence. You can bring anything to life.
Right, because it doesn't seem like it's, you know, it's about the clothes, obviously,
right,
fashion, but that's not all it is.
Right? Right. A lot of people feel like they're more comfortable with wearing something because of the name. Whatever hot they feel like or out there now, they feel like those names actually what carries you over into the wind. I feel like the style carries me over. I can be wearing something less than what you have on, but my style is 10 times better than yours. I feel like that is more of a strong statement than actually the name of the clothing you have on. If we take away the label of the clothing and we don't know what he or she have on, then what are we actually judging?
So tell me more about that. Like, why is the fashion category important to you? Like, what does it do for you, not just in ballroom, but generally? Because, I mean, it says,
okay,
you're talking about, like, confidence and, you know, style. Yeah.
Well, As far as outside of ballroom in my church, I am a youth choir director, so I have to dress up in church too. My father is also a pastor, so I was always in church, and I was always the little boy that dressed up really nice. So me being a part of church, my mother in fashion, then me being a drum major dressing up, I just feel like all those went together. Everything represented me on the outside and inside. I don't know if it happens for everybody, but a lot of people that's connected to dance, they normally dance at a dance studio outside, or they have workspace outside of ballroom. But I just think that was a category for me.
Okay, I'm going to ask a few more questions about the category. I want to know, like, how does it feel when you're walking that category, when you feel like you're doing really well with that category? Like, how do you feel differently than you would feel in your everyday life?
I feel like I have a whole nother personality when I walk the category, because that gives me a time where I don't have to be the Sebastian everybody know on the street. I can be the ballroom Sebastian. So that ballroom Sebastian has his own personality. And when I walk the category, I feel like I just have more confident. It's some type of confidence, a feeling that I can't describe it, but it's more where I know I'm competing. I know I want to be seen. I know I want to make an impact, and I want to make a moment. So I'm doing all those things to make sure that it come across correctly and execute it correctly so they can remember. So if I'm battling someone, I know if I'm battling a guy, and if I have to battle a male figure, I'm going to do it very masculine. Or if I'm battling a female, I'm going to be masculine, but I'm going to be a little bit edgy because I know she has on a gown. I know she's swinging her gown, so I might have to swing my arm or my gloves. I'm going to be right in between, because you never know with that fashion category. Someone can beat you in a full gown, or, you know, it's very hard for a male figure to beat a female figure anyway. I don't care what nobody say, because a male figure to me in ballroom is like the female carrying a pocketbook, like a man is normally a pocketbook to a woman. Mm-hmm. So you have to really be on your game that night if you're going to beat a woman in a gown.
And you said, okay, I've heard this word from a few people, you want to create a moment. What does that mean?
A moment is when you actually have decreed your category, meaning that night you pulled out all the bells and whistles and stops for that category. You did something that everybody, when they leave that night, they will say, out of all those categories, that one category, best dress, I enjoyed what he or she did. I've never seen that. You want to create a moment where not only are you just walking your category, you want them to remember you. I'm not saying set yourself on fire and win the category, but you want to make a statement that when they talk about what you did that night, it goes from state to state, where people wasn't there and they going home and they getting online and they want to see what you did, and people saying, oh my God, you look really nice. What made you do that? So that's what makes you a star, a statement, and then a legend. If you do something really, really, really big and it lasts for years and years to come, you become a legend, because you remember that night when he did this or she did that. So you definitely want to make a statement in ballroom every time.
And I guess that connects to what you were saying about Jack Nasrallah, or the commentators. You know, they're chanting at the balls, like, bring it, like.
They remember all those good things that's happened in ballroom.
They remember those moments.
Yeah, they remember those moments. So if there's a moment that people don't remember, or he has to talk, if you have to find out about that, that will come from them. Because Jack was in ballroom way before I was in ballroom. Like, they were in ballroom in the 80s. Back in the 80s, I was still in middle school, you know.
And I guess if you create that moment, like, you become part of that.
You become
history.
Part of that history, yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, I love it. Okay, more questions. Maybe we'll talk for another, like, 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
Let's see, categories. You talked about gender. Well, what else do you think is important to record about ballroom? Not just the balls, but the whole world.
I think there's a misconception that ballroom, at the end of the day, is just for fun. That's just a small piece of ballroom. I think ballroom helps to bring people together dealing with different crises in their lives. As far as there are people in ballroom that may have been suicidal, there may have been people in ballroom who are homeless, but when they join these houses, 99% of the time, the leaders of the houses connect them with different things outside of ballroom that will help them along with having a productive life and a better lifestyle living outside of ballroom. So the misconception is that there are a bunch of people going to balls and they're walking balls and they're not doing anything with their lives. There are people in ballroom that are doctors. They have doctor's degrees. They are sitting on boards of different organizations. They are doing extraordinary work in the community. Some people you may never know that were ballroom walkers at the time that are, I consider them as being alumni of ballroom. They may not be around anymore, but you can't just go into a place and start talking about ballroom and not think that someone was once a part of it. So there are people like that in the world that exist, and I think that ballroom helps to create a place where the youth that's coming in definitely have a system or a vessel to get to a point where they can have any type of financial or any type of need they need, medical assistance to help provide them with a better lifestyle.
So in ballroom, you get people from all parts of the social strata, from like homeless to people who are doctors and so forth. Okay.
Yeah, like we have a few members from the House of Scott that are like, we have one that's no longer in our house now, but he's about to be a doctor. You know, then we have another one that's a nurse. We have different people in different houses that are doing like really good things. And I think that, like I said before, the misconception is they're not doing anything with themselves. Mm-hmm. And they really are. They're doing a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so maybe this is a bigger question, but what is the role of homophobia or racism, do you think, in terms of the ballroom world? Like, you know, that's, ballroom is kind of like an alternative world, but there's also this mainstream world that is homophobic, is racist.
I think a lot of people feel if they're connected or any people that they know is connected to ballroom, it's actually define them as being gay. And that's not a true statement, because with any type of hobby or anything that's going on in the world, people should want to see what's going on without being ridiculed. And I think a lot of people just don't actually come in to find out what's going on because they are worrying about what other people may say. But I think being like that, stereotyping ballroom or saying that people in ballroom or being homophobic, I think that's very cave-like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't live in the Old Testament anymore, so it's like you have to wake up and realize that a lot of things are happening because they're supposed to happen, and a lot of things were hidden back then because they were supposed to hide them. But nowadays, you know, we have people that are actually doing things. They're coming out. You know, we have sports people. We have people playing football coming out saying, you know, they're gay. So I think with all that, those things being done, why not try to explore what's actually going on? You can make a better judgment on what's going on if you're actually there and see what's going on.
Let's see. How do you think ballroom has changed over the past 10 years or 25 years?
One time ballroom, you had to actually be there to understand what was going on. But now, because we have Facebook and we have all these, we didn't have the internet as accessible as it was back then. So now you can be at home and you can watch little Johnny Vogue at these 10 to 15 different balls, and you can learn how to Vogue from watching Little Johnny. You couldn't do that 25 years ago. You actually had to be there. And like now, you know, you can get online, you can learn how to, and I'm going to give you another example, you can get online and learn how to change the battery in your car or change spark plugs. You know, I'm not a person to know how to change spark plugs, but if I really want to learn, you know, bad enough, I learn. So it's easier now to do those things. That's the one thing I can say has changed for ballroom. You have more people now that want to have status in ballroom. They're and the status meaning they want to be labeled as legendary. Back then, you didn't have that opportunity to even make to suggest that. That came along with Jack calling you out as legendary, or somebody who's in ballroom for a very long time doing that. But now they have systems and collisions set in place where they can actually appoint people to different categories. We didn't have that, like a council. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have councils that actually go around and give you the names of different people that have been in ballrooms for years, and then we try to give them titles or give them their legendary status. We didn't have that back then, so that's mm-hmm. different too. What else?
So now there's actually a council who's responsible for deciding if you're legendary or an icon?
Yes.
And
yes.
Who sits on that council?
You have different councils in different states, different regions. There's a council in the Midwest. There's a council in New York. Sometimes you can bypass a council, and if you have three icons that say they want to make you a legend, you can do that. Like me and two other icons can make someone a legend. But what we do is we try to compile all their information and see do they qualify. Like I wouldn't want to make a decision on somebody being a legend or an icon if I know for myself I've been to more balls than them and I've won more balls than them, as far as them being a legend now. Because nowadays, to be a legend, I feel that if a person just became a legend before you, you should have done it just as much as that person did, or more than what that person has done before you become. You shouldn't be coming in with doing half of the things that person done before you, who is just deemed. So you should have be